Welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast. My name is Aljean Lewis, and I'm a senior associate in CDH's pro bono and human rights practice. The 20th of June marks World Refugee Day, an international day designated by the United Nations to honor refugees around the globe. This day seeks to acknowledge and celebrate the strength and courage of people who have been forced to flee their home country to escape conflict or persecution. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming guests who will share their experiences on the work they do within the refugee space. I'm joined by Yasmin Raja, the founder and director of Refugee Social Services, an NGO based in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal. Yasmin is a qualified registered social worker with expertise in forced migration, child protection, sexual and gender-based violence, and HIV and issues concerning documentation and statelessness. She currently works with migrant communities with particular emphasis on service provision to refugees and migrants in the urban settings. I'm also joined by Nabila Mia, head of the Penal Reform Program and manager of the Detention Monitoring Unit at Lawyers for Human Rights. Nabila is an admitted attorney and has experience working on public interest litigation with an emphasis on constitutional law, refugee law, and international law, but to name a few. A very warm welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining. Before we delve into what I'm sure will be a very interesting and important discussion, for the benefit of those listening and who are not too familiar with the civil society space and the organizations represented here today, I would like each of you to please briefly tell us about your organization and the services provided to the public. Yasmin, please go ahead and share with us the work that RSS does.
Hello. Thank you, Aljean, for actually inviting us. So my name is Yasmin Raja. I'm from Refugee Social Services. Our organization is based in KZN. Services we provide to refugees and asylum seekers is generally around managing their mental health. So it's counseling, it's referral services, it's helping them to orientate and understand how South Africa works, what their rights are, what their responsibilities in the country are. But like everybody else in any community, people have issues, they have problems, and we're one of those organizations that would actually provide social services, so information on where to access health, education, and other services, but also on our own, we would provide counseling, mental health support. We facilitate access to other services. That's just in a nutshell. We also do a lot of community work where we provide information out into the community so that they, in their own languages, so that they know where they can access services for different things, including HIV, gender-based violence, child protection, health, education, and such like.
Thank you very much for sharing with us, Yasmin. That certainly sounds very exciting and important work, and I'm sure it's positively contributed to many lived realities of asylum seekers and refugees in this space.
Just wanted to say, most certainly it does, because what we fail to realize sometimes when people come through, that aside from the challenges they face because they're refugees, they also face challenges of integrating and figuring out their space. You might come in with your husband and your family or with family members, and the issues that impact on South African communities, you know, in any family also impacts on refugee communities. So just to bring that to the fore, because that's also one of the things that we have to help quite frequently with.
Absolutely important stuff. Nabila, I will hand over to you to tell us a little bit about the work that LHR does in this space.
Thank you so much, Aljean. Lawyers for Human Rights is a 45-year-old public interest law organization. We were established in 1979. Our roots are founded in assisting people who have been detained and subjected to harsh punishments under the apartheid regime. But following the end of apartheid, we pivoted to do work across six broad thematic areas: refugee and migrant rights, land, housing and property rights, penal reform, which is prisoners and detained persons' rights, strategic litigation, gender equality, and environmental rights. Our refugee and migrant rights program is our biggest program across the board, and it was established in about 1996. We provide direct legal services to asylum seekers, refugees, and migrants broadly through three walk-in clinics located in Durban, Pretoria, and Johannesburg. However, our reach is national in that we have partners operating in other parts of the country where we provide our assistance through. While our services are directly legal to provide legal assistance, and our very mission statements is about making rights real and assisting people directly through legal services, we also take a more holistic change to reform and make rights real by parliamentary advocacy or media advocacy or through regional and international human rights mechanisms, as well as being founded in significant community empowerment and education work, where we do a significant number of outreaches, because Lawyers for Human Rights takes its mandate from the people who seek our services. So the most significant way that we can give back is to empower people through their knowledge of the rights and their confidence to be able to use that knowledge.
Thank you, Nabila. I think it's important that you've mentioned that LHR seeks to take its mandate from the communities that they serve. It's very important, I think, in the civil society space. And I think LHR has the reputation of upholding human rights and acting as an agent on behalf of these communities. And many times this means going up against government and holding ministers accountable when they failed to uphold their statutory and constitutional duties. Now, something that we will discuss a little bit later on is the political shift we've seen as it relates to asylum seekers and refugees' rights in the country. And this recently showed its head in the form of the White Paper on Citizenship, Immigration, and Refugee Protection. But there have been what I would say concerning signs that have come before the White Paper that sort of foreshadowed that the rights of asylum seekers and refugees are to be severely restricted in the coming years. And I think one of these signs was the amendment to the Refugees Act that was signed into law in 2017 and that came into effect on 1 January 2020. Nabila, please share with us some of the issues that arose from the Refugees Amendment Act that had a direct impact on refugee rights in South Africa. And please also share with us cases that have been brought in relation to the amendments, including LHR's most recent case, which seeks to challenge the constitutional validity of certain provisions of the Refugees Act and regulations thereto.
I think that what you would have found since the Refugees Amendment Act came into effect in 2020 was what we see as a lot of administrative procedural routes that asylum seekers do not comply with will see them being barred from accessing the asylum system. Now, take a step back, people might be asking, well, if they were signed into law in 2017 and they came into effect in 2020, why are a lot of them only being implemented now? What we've seen is that, first of all, due to COVID-19, where there was a lot of uncertainty around the operation of the refugee reception offices and spread of COVID-19, a lot of refugee reception offices were closed and people weren't able to access refugee reception offices in South Africa and couldn't lodge their asylum claims. And so a lot of these procedural requirements could not be implemented. At least that's how we're seeing them. The fact that the refugee reception offices were closed themselves led to a significant number of people not being able to apply for asylum or being able to lodge their applications. And the refugee reception offices tried to stem this by creating an online system, but that online system itself was prohibitive in that not everyone had access to technology to be able to lodge an asylum application online. But to go back to the issue about the amendments that came into effect, what we saw was the implementation of sections that effectively said that if you didn't take certain administrative steps, it would result in your refugee claim not being processed or your refugee claim being abandoned, so to speak. So I'm going to talk about two aspects thereof. The first being a provision that was implemented, which we call the abandonment provisions, which essentially said that if you did not apply for renewal of your asylum seeker permit within a specific period of time, it would be considered abandoned. What that meant was that people who weren't able to go physically in person to renew their asylum seeker claims, regardless of what their circumstances were, would be constituted to have their asylum applications abandoned, which meant that they didn't have a valid status to be here in South Africa and might be deported back to their countries of origin and effectively refouled. And what we mean by refouled is that they might be returned to the countries of origin where they would be under threat or direct persecution as a result of the public war that might be happening in their country, or as a result of their belonging to a certain grouping, a certain religion, a certain tribe. And just because they weren't able to comply with the procedural requirement, they would thus face deportation. So that, of course, was quite a significant challenge. And this was addressed through a constitutional court case brought by the Dalibini Center of Cape Town. And Lawyers for Human Rights in that matter represented the Consortium of Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, CUMSA. Our contribution to that was that if parents' asylum applications were considered to be abandoned because of these provisions, because they didn't renew them in time, that would in turn affect their children, because children's claims are tied to their parents' asylum applications. And the effect of these provisions was that they didn't take into account children's rights. And as you know, those abandonment provisions were declared to be unconstitutional and are no longer in effect. Then the other significant case, and what we noticed because of what came into effect because of certain provisions in the Refugees Amendment Act, are the fact that there are sections that were brought into effect that are currently in the Refugees Amendment Act, which now seek to bar people effectively from accessing the asylum system due to what is effectively an immigration infraction. So Section 4 of the Refugees Act effectively bars people from accessing refugee status for three reasons. You can be excluded from refugee status if you were found to be in possession of a fraudulent identity document or passport or permit. So if there was an infraction related to an immigration fraud, which is what that section encompasses, and then the two other problematic sections that we highlighted is that you could be excluded from accessing refugee status if you entered South Africa other than through a port of entry, for example, through other means that the government considers to be illicit, and you can't show good cause to an immigration official as to why it is that you entered that way, you would be excluded from accessing refugee status. And then the third one is that the Refugees Act currently provides that when you enter into South Africa, you have to report to a refugee reception office within 5 days of entering South Africa. Now, the refugee reception offices are located quite scattered across the country. And oftentimes, people who enter South Africa don't speak English. They face financial challenges related to travel, related to food, and if they don't know where these refugee reception offices are, they aren't able to even know that they have to report there within 5 days. That then would exclude someone who didn't know in the first place that they would have to report to a refugee reception office within 5 days. So the common thread is around these exclusions are that they relate to more procedural elements that would bar a bona fide asylum seeker from accessing an asylum application. Specifically, one of the more problematic ones that we highlighted was the good cause requirement. How that plays out is that if you entered South Africa through a means other than through the border post, you would then at the refugee reception office have to have an interview with an immigration official as to why you entered the way that you did. If you do not meet the standard that the immigration official expects of you, you might not then even be able to access the asylum system. Now, we know that people fleeing from other countries where there's war, they're desperate. Some people just leave with nothing but the clothes on their back. Some people don't speak English. And along the way, they are subjected to people taking advantage of them, who say to them, come with me through XYZ means, and you will be safe, and I will take you to safety in South Africa. They don't know that they have to enter through a specific way for it to be considered legal by authorities, and that then bars them from accessing the asylum system if they cannot show good cause, and they might then be detained and deported back to the very danger that they were fleeing. So we're seeking to challenge this through litigation in the Western Cape High Court. We represent the Scalabrini Centre of Cape Town, and we're challenging both the requirement under the Refugees Act that is seeking to bar people from accessing the asylum application, as well as the detention and deportation and effectively refoulement of bona fide asylum seekers just because of what is a procedural requirement.
Thanks so much, Nabila. I think as I was listening to you, what comes to mind is the fact that the amendments that were brought into the Refugees Act by the Department of Home Affairs is so far removed from the inefficiencies we see operating within the Department of Home Affairs, and especially at RROs. The abandonment clause, for example, doesn't really consider the fact that RROs are overworked, they're not working efficiently, people are given appointments, but then are not attended to when they do pitch up for those appointments. And I mean, we know the problems that the RROs are riddled with because they've been riddled with these problems for many, many years. And Home Affairs has always said that they, you know, every year they sort of have a project to deal with these issues. But I don't think we've ever seen any of these issues being solved. And I think another point I also want to make is government always comes out against civil society, especially when litigation is instituted. And I think it would be remiss of us to not acknowledge at this point that despite LHR and other civil society organizations litigating against departments, it's certainly not the first port of call. I think as practitioners who often have to work with the state to try and ensure that clients have access to the rights afforded to them by legislation, that we do try and engage with the department at some level or at all levels, but often those attempts fall on deaf ears. And so it is very often the case that we have to go to court and ask the court for assistance in order to vindicate not only the rights of the clients who give us our mandate, but also the rights of those similarly placed.
Thanks very much for that, Algina. I think you're correct. In fact, through all our litigation, we go through an extensive engagement period with the Department of Home Affairs or whatever department might be litigated against, and involving our partners in this process. So in leading up to this litigation that I mentioned, the most recent one, we did quite an extensive reaching out to our partners who work with the other refugee reception officers. And we also had a meeting with the Department of Home Affairs, but could not reach consensus. And I think that what is significant is that these issues don't only affect asylum seekers and migrants and refugees, but also South Africans who are trying to access normal day-to-day services through the Department of Home Affairs. We would love to be able to take the approach of innovating with specific departments to try and address certain issues, and rather than having us go through a litigation process, actually work effectively hand in hand. But often that is not possible.
Absolutely, Nabila, I agree with you. Engaging with Department of Home Affairs, I think, is quite difficult because their agenda often is mismatched from what we are trying to achieve. Earlier on, we spoke about the political shift we saw with regards to the rights afforded to asylum seekers and refugees in South Africa. And while in the past several years, we've seen small attempts made to realize the shift, I think we were all stunned at the end of last year when the minister issued the draft white paper on citizenship, immigration, and refugee protection, not only because of how quickly it progressed, but also because of its content. Now, the time that was afforded to interested parties to submit comments on the draft was wholly inadequate, given the significance of the document and its impact that it sought to achieve. And some people have said, yes, but it's only a policy paper. But I think the fact that it is a policy paper and not necessarily legislation does not, in my opinion, detract from the importance of the document and how it can impact the rights of vulnerable groups. And even though the deadline was eventually extended by a few weeks, the time given was again significant. And I'm emphasizing this point because this is one of the ways that government really stifles public participation and certainly meaningful public participation by not allowing parties to extensively consult and consider and really work through the significance of the proposed policy changes. Now, unfortunately, I won't speak through all of the issues and proposals in the white paper. There are far too many to discuss in the short amount of time, but I think one of the most significant proposals made in the paper is the intention to withdraw South Africa from the 1951 UN Refugee Convention and the 1969 OAU Convention in order to re-accede to these conventions with reservations and exceptions that I think will ultimately restrict asylum seekers and refugees' ability to access socioeconomic rights. And this position, to me at least, is quite surprising given how South Africa has recently been very active in the international space and advocating for the protection of human rights. The position in the white paper demonstrates a complete shift from this position that South Africa currently has, and also a complete shift from the progressive stance South Africa took when they enacted the Refugees Act in 1998. And should South Africa withdraw from these conventions, the strong jurisprudence on the rights of asylum seekers and refugees that has been built up through our courts will certainly be at jeopardy. Unfortunately, because the white paper doesn't speak to which reservations South Africa would make, it's unclear at this stage how government intends to marry the reservations with its obligations that are rooted in international customary law and other international human rights treaties that South Africa are still party to. And further, the white paper is also silent on some very important issues like xenophobia and what the department intends on doing to curb xenophobia in South Africa. It's silent on the protection of vulnerable groups such as the LGBTQIA+ community. Instead, the white paper seeks to intentionally restrict the rights of asylum seekers and refugees in the country, which, as mentioned before, goes against the spirit of the Constitution and its intended effect to protect everyone within the borders of South Africa. So I would say the result of publishing the white paper together with the amendments to the Refugees Act have left asylum seekers and refugees in a precarious position because it has created instability and uncertainty as to whether they continue to be protected within the ambit of the law and certainly within the ambit of the protections entrenched in the Constitution. Nabila or Yasin, if you have any contributions to the white paper.
Yeah, so I think the white paper and the legislation, the amendments that came previously that Nabila was discussing, all seem to show us that current government is taking a very hardline view when it comes to migration. And I'm not sure if it comes from within a particular political party or where the thinking is coming from, but it seems like we're also following on, you know, some sort of global more conservative ideas about migration and, you know, migration being blamed for everything that is wrong in a country. And unfortunately, refugees and asylum seekers who are already victimized because of conflicts in other areas are re-victimized in countries that are supposed to be giving refuge. And in organizations like ours, we see this continual re-victimization and vulnerability that actually comes because of policies. And one of the things I'd like to say is that, you know, when people make policies and laws and decisions that are used to govern the country, your ordinary person on the street doesn't always know or understand what the law says and what the law means. And the decisions made directly impact on people. So when these things happen, when the white paper comes about, it's showing us where the policy direction is going. And when the amendment comes in, you know, the amendments came in 2020, took what was essentially a very progressive legislation that we had and took it back to more aggressive sort of laws and stuff. It had a direct impact on the people that are here already, but they don't understand exactly why these things are happening or how the legislation is impacting them. And I don't know if the lawmakers actually know that there's people behind the decisions they make and that some of these decisions cause some really, really difficult situations for children, for older people, for all those that are here.
I think just to pick up on one of your points there, Yasmin, at the end of the day, on a global level, many constitutions or country governing documents or regime do not provide migrants with voting powers. For example, so Africa's constitution is one of the most progressive in the world, but people who are entitled to vote are citizens. And so where governments might seek to favor a certain view or try to get re-elected or new parties wish to enter into political space, often the target for inefficiencies and a key political pandering point is to have to scapegoat migrants. And that's what they do. And hence this global phenomenon of far-right anti-migrant sentiment that is being pushed forward in political campaigns. And that is quite significant the way it's recorded here in South Africa. You will remember that Pan-Africanism and the concept of Ubuntu has always been a flagship of South Africa post-apartheid. But this is something that as political powers have lost footing, there is but one group that is being targeted to blame for shortcomings, and those are migrants who political parties don't have to pander to for votes.
Thank you, Yasmin and Nabila, for those comments. One passing comment that I have, and I think it speaks to both of your points, is that the white paper is also not steeped in facts and evidence. And it very much plays into this narrative that foreign nationals, like you mentioned, Yasmin, are squarely to blame for South Africa's problems. For a long time, I've said that I don't think Home Affairs sees their responsibility and the impact that the decision-making powers have on the lived realities of people in the country. I think they very much look at their role as a very administrative process, but it has large implications at the end of the day. But I would like to turn now to how the legislative changes and the policies have played out on the ground. Yasmin, you mentioned earlier that your organization offers services that seek to upskill asylum seekers and refugees in order to facilitate a process where they can integrate into society. And I think this is something that's very phenomenal. But part of that integration is also the process of being documented and remaining documented. However, I think we can all agree that in our experience, the process of documentation can be hindered by Home Affairs itself. Yasmin, please share with us your experience in trying to assist asylum seekers and refugees being unable or having difficulty with renewing their documentation. And please also share with us how the inability to renew documentation creates barriers in accessing basic services.
You know, I've been working in this sector for the last 21 years, and I think since around 2015 going on 2017 with the changes that have been coming, we've seen in the community the increase in the stress levels and the mental health, the progressively decreasing and poor mental health of our clients. Now, remember, our clients come from traumatic situations anyway. They've been forced to leave under difficult circumstances. They've experienced loss. A lot of the women that we actually work with have been victims of gender-based violence, rapes in particular. And so they've experienced a lot of hardship getting to South Africa, to a place where they think they're going to get refuge. And unfortunately, in the last few years, we've seen how there's been more systematic challenges that they've come up against, and this causes, you know, secondary trauma. we've seen an increase in GBV. And when I say this, because when you don't get documents, it doesn't just, your document is a gateway to services on the one hand, but in our situation, it's a gateway to getting income. It's a gateway to health, to education. So the people that we actually work with, I think, and I just need to describe, sometimes I'm not sure if people realize that these refugees and asylum seekers range in age from 0 to, and in our case, the oldest client we have is 92. And our 92-year-old, till today, she's been in the country probably from about 2015, is still on an asylum seeker permit, on a rejected asylum seeker permit, awaiting a refugee status. So with the help of LHR and with ourselves checking out why she left and stuff like that, she has a refugee claim. Her claim has not been properly processed. And what it means directly for her is that for the last almost 10 years, because she's waiting in limbo, she's had to look after herself, but she doesn't qualify then, for instance, for an old age pension. This is a 92-year-old that still has to work to support herself. Thank God for her, she's in very good health, so she sells vegetables on the street. But even then, she's in a precarious position because she doesn't have a permit to actually trade on the streets. This is with an elderly person. We also then have cases where amongst the community, there's people with very special needs. So there's disabilities, there's children with intellectual issues. We've got cases with like severe autism. And most of these people are either waiting to secure an appointment to actually get a document, or they're trying to renew their documents, or they've been sitting on an asylum document for umpteen years, and life goes on. The traumas that come in a household situation, you're finding families are, they're so traumatized by the fact that they don't have documentation, prevents you from earning an income. It puts barriers in the place for getting health services, getting into school. So basically, the trauma that most people are suffering right now is immense, and it's gotten worse over the years. More and more in the last year, the continued narrative in the media around illegal immigrants and undocumented illegal immigrants, I mean, with the political parties going on these campaigns to vilify those people that are undocumented and calling them illegal and doing all sorts of things, we're finding that people in the community are afraid to be on the streets, afraid to go about their daily work because they're afraid to be picked up by police, Metro Police, or by SAPS. We've had people waiting for over 2 years to try and get an asylum, an appointment for an asylum document. We've had to advise women in particular to actually take their children with them when they go for these interviews. Otherwise, there was a likelihood of mothers being detained and the children left with nobody to care for them. So we've had a lot of issues. One of the other things is we oftentimes have newcomers that are pregnant, women that are pregnant, and we find that these women give birth and then they're waiting years before they can even try to register the birth of the child. As you know, birth registration actually is dependent on parents' status and the validity of their visa in the country. So, you know, we have these sort of issues. We've had a lot of cases of intimate partner violence and abandonment and financial abuse. In our opinion, and from what, you know, discussions with the families, based largely on the fact that people are stressed, they're not able to actually survive, the root cause goes down to documentation.
Thank you, Yasmin. I think I agree with you that, you know, South Africa is a country that is so centered on documentation, and trying to access any service without documentation is extremely difficult. And sometimes without some sort of legal intervention, it's almost impossible to gain access to these services. So sometimes I think that the public disconnect between asylum seekers and refugees really stems from a place of people, I think, as you said, Yasmin, not understanding the refugee system and its complexities, but also from mistruths being in the public domain that people think are true. For me, one of the misconceptions that people have and that I often hear are that children who are born in South Africa are automatically South African. which is absolutely not true. You know, if a child is born in South Africa to foreign national parents, they follow their nationality. And while the law does allow for a child born in South Africa to foreign national parents to apply for citizenship, that can only happen when they turn 18, and they must meet stringent requirements in order to qualify for this. So I'm quickly going to ask the two of you to give me some of the mistruths that you've heard that you would like to dispel. Yasmin, I think we'll start with you. What is something that you often hear that is not true and that you would like to dispel?
Well, I think a lot of South Africans we encounter feel that refugees and asylum seekers have access to Social Security. Only recognized refugees have access, and that has only been probably for the last, I think it was since 2009. And there's lots and lots of challenges even accessing those Social Security grants. But there's a feeling amongst people in general that, you know, asylum seekers and refugees come around and they easily access all these grants. In fact, I think there was a social media post that was almost viral going around working out how much people get. So they've got six kids and they get 500 rand per child, and then there's one disabled person there and one pensioner. And so somebody worked out that this household is collecting from the government in the region of 20,000 rand or something like that, some strange number. And it's a blatant mistruth, because you can't access it unless you're a recognized refugee. And even then, there's challenges, because if you are able to actually get, say, for instance, a child support grant as a recognized refugee, it's the timing of that grant is based on the validity of your permit. So if your permit expires, the grant stops. And then with the process of reapplication, there's always a lag with the grant. So like a South African might get a child support grant, for instance, and until the child is 18, there won't be any stop or any sort of cancellation of the grant. But in the case of refugees who qualify, which are very, very few, you'll find that this happens. There's an impression that refugees and asylum seekers have businesses and they're quite wealthy. Not in our experience. We find that they struggle. People are struggling immensely just to meet basic needs.
Nabila, I'm going to ask you the same question. Please share with us a myth you would like to dispel.
For me, it's the myth around people abusing the asylum system for wanting a job or a better life in South Africa, people accessing the asylum system fraudulently. One thing that I've learned and is quite significant in this process is that the asylum seekers and refugees that we meet through our work are people who haven't wanted to leave their country of origin. They are being forced to leave it because of what is happening in those countries. People who were quite well established in their lives, they had families, they had networks, they had a life that they built up in their countries of origin. They were doctors, lawyers, teachers, and they come to South Africa trying to access the asylum system and can't even use the skills that they've spent often their whole lives learning and working through, because those opportunities aren't provided for asylum seekers and refugees to be able to access because of the delays around the accessing the asylum applications. People aren't able to get jobs, nevertheless the jobs that they're trained for. And so this myth that people come here to try and steal jobs, try and steal resources, it's not fair. If we think of all of us sitting here in this quote-unquote room, you know, if we were being persecuted here today, if we were being forced to run from our lives today with no recourse, we'd pick up and go. And imagine the thought of not being able to use the skills that you've learned, to not be able to see the family that you see every day, to not be able to see the friends and community that you see every day. Would you voluntarily do that? Probably not. And so that's a big risk that I would like to dispel.
And I think just to add on to what Nabila is saying, we see the loneliness, which is why one of the things we've very often tried to do at RSS is create the spaces where people get to meet each other and try to set up support systems, because when you leave home and you leave all your support systems behind, it is extremely lonely. You don't have the networks that you need for when you're in challenging conditions.
Thank you for that, Nabila and Yasmin. I think that's a powerful way to end off today's episode. I don't think people give a lot of thought to the courage that it takes to flee from your home country that you've known all your life, coming to a foreign country where you are treated so badly and where the problems of that country is put squarely on you. Yasmin and Nabila, thank you very much for an amazing discussion. Thank you all for listening. And I hope the discussion today has been enriching and insightful, in line with the United Nations theme for World Refugee Day this year, which is a world where refugees are welcome. The hope is that South Africa remains committed to the plight of asylum seekers and refugees, its international obligations, and promoting a more welcoming and inclusive South Africa for all.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.